I'm Spencer Bailey. This is Time Sensitive. Hey everyone, thanks again to those of you who have joined the Slowdown's new membership program. At just $100 a year, the subscription provides access to our slate of new member-only newsletters, in-depth stories, immersive interviews, curated recommendations, and exclusive event invitations. If you haven't already checked it out and want to learn more, or if you'd simply like to support this podcast and all that we do at the Slowdown, go to slowdown.tv/subscribe. That's slowdown.tv/subscribe. On this week's episode, I talk with the British designer, creative director, and artist Samuel Ross. Samuel is best known for founding the brutalism-tinged fashion label A Cold Wall, which sits at the nexus of streetwear and high fashion, and for his work earlier in his career with the late Virgil Abloh. Samuel also runs the industrial design studio SRA, and has collaborated with brands including Nike, Converse, and Timberland. At just 32 years old, Samuel has an honorary doctorate from the University of Westminster in London, and his work is in the collections of the Dallas Museum of Art, the Museum of Fine Arts Houston, and the Victoria and Albert Museum, the latter of which presented an exhibition of his fashion work last year. Through his Black British Artist Grants program, he's providing a platform, resources, and funding to young and unsung creators across fashion, art, illustration, industrial design, architecture, and photography. Several of his design pieces are currently on view in a solo exhibition at New York's Friedman Benda Gallery through June 17th, and he also recently created a series of abstract works for an exhibition at London's White Cube Gallery. We talk a bit about both shows on the episode. I'm always weary of the term polymath, but Samuel is someone who, through his multidisciplinary creative practice, lives up to the term's intersectional ideals. It's not easy to define or pinpoint his practice, but I'm sure he wouldn't have it any other way. Given the wide breadth of the work we discuss on the episode, I recommend visiting timesensitive.fm to check out the hyperlinks and images. It will probably help make a bit more sense of what we discuss. Before we get into the episode, I'd first like to thank our Season 7 presenting sponsor, the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels, which this year is working with the American Museum of Natural History in New York to present the exhibition Garden of Green, Exquisite Jewelry by Van Cleef & Arpels at the museum's Mignone Hall of Gems and Minerals. On view from June 10th, 2023 through January 2024, Garden of Green will showcase 44 creations from the French High Jewelry House, 32 of which will be on view in the U.S. for the first time. Creating a lush garden of jewelry, this impressive array of precious and ornamental green stones will form a dazzling journey that celebrates the beauty of gardens and nature. One area of the exhibition space will highlight a diversity of green stones. Another will concentrate on particular materials such as jade, chrysoprase, and malachite. And a third will display a selection of majestic creations set with emeralds. You can learn more at www.amnh.org/exhibitions. That's www.amnh.org/exhibitions. And now, here's my conversation with Samuel. Hi, Samuel. Welcome to Time Sensitive.
Spencer, it's a joy to be here.
I thought we'd start today with Course. This is your current show at Friedman Benda Gallery here in New York, and there are just 6 objects in it. I was struck by how these pieces seem to be out of time, meaning of no time, or at least not any linear timeline, found somewhere between our primordial past and this like distant, far-off future. They're kind of relics in a way. And I was wondering if you could speak to that, like this particular body of work from a temporal perspective.
You know, I've got this obsession with kind of deep diving into so many different forums of literature, whether it be, you know, fiction or nonfiction or editorial, or whether it be, you know, ingesting historical, you know, documents on like Cambridge Archives online or via lo-fi independent YouTube documentaries, which are actually forming some of the more like specific niche inputs of information that you can't necessarily find in traditional forums of thought, specifically related to design and object and architecture and material. And that type of pendulum swing between different historic movements, whether it's like an inquiry into Benin in the Edo period, or whether it's actually feudal Japan's Edo period, or whether it's looking at the implication of the Venetian Palazzo during like 15th century Renaissance period, whether it's the inquiry into the history of folk art across the British Isles, all the way through to the work of Moore or Caro or Hepworth or Whitread, the joy and organic inquiry of wanting to ingest information ends up dissolving any type of chronological way of seeing object and seeing the world. And with course, with this particular body of work, I'm noticing this is almost becoming a bit more of a behavior in terms of how I think about material and form. And there's a freedom there in being able to extract and move and jump and collage between these different inputs that I'm just curious about.
At the opening, I was speaking with Glenn Adamson, who has also been a guest on this podcast, the great craft scholar. And he mentioned to me that there are really three central themes, as he sees it, to this body of work: ritual, essence, and alchemy. On the surface, those sound kind of heady, you know.
Indeed.
But I was hoping we could unpack them here.
Sure.
I would love to hear about how you think about those three words, ritual, essence, and alchemy, in the context of this work.
You know, if we think about the word ritual, and we think about public forum, and you think about the placement of public art, you know, let's think about Kensington Gardens, Henry Moore installation just behind Serpentine, and the questions that it kind of brings forward of who, what, why, when, how, where. It doesn't maybe answer, but it presents itself and projects these questions to the everyday human. You know, there's no bias in needing to ask that question because there's maybe a certain level of understanding of the arts or materiality. There's this like decorum of democracy, and the idea of ritual and gathering and pulling those opinions feels quite humanistic. And there's something there with public art and congregation and ritual that I'm deeply interested in. I think the same when I think about, you know, early Caro work and what it kind of represented to the public forum. And if you think about, you know, Whitread's breakthrough piece of work in East London, which was then taken down
after the house,
which was then taken down.
Yeah.
There is this reverence around the monolith, which continues to almost propose a new way of appearing for every generation. And there's something deeply human and intrinsic about that, which is, you know, almost etching into the subconscious. And the more time I spend considering the implication of ritual in modern times, in the time in which we live and how we all engage and experience reality in space, I cannot ignore that pull or gray area to fill that with, you know, ritualistic object, whether it be through the medium of furniture or, you know, temporary architecture or sculpture. There's a need for that to be filled. And I keep returning to that talking point or matter or that. And it's not really a talking point, it's a feeling. Mm. It feels like my contribution needs to be for public, and the idea of ritual and public can't be separated, specifically when you consider some of the influences of course and the wider umbrella of my work, the relationship between, you know, the ideas of utopia through architecture, through postmodern and brutalist and modernist architecture across Europe and the UK. And, you know, maybe some of the unfortunate calamities which weren't achieved, but actually had a very much altruistic or optimistic underpinning of how people would engage with space as they did in, you know, the golden age of the Renaissance. I'm interested at that tension point.
What about essence and alchemy?
essence connects to ritual in such like a, the two are so connected, right? You think ritual and you think essence. I kind of, it's almost like they're like magnets. You know, you need both.
Yeah.
You know, ritual kind of elicits and pulls and speaks to essence. And, you know, the interesting matter there is that essence, the two ways to kind of look at essence is like the non-physical, and then there's almost like the metaphysical. And by that, I mean the idea of like the genome and like, you know, platelets and like cells. And if you think about the medieval system of the humors and how you kind of broke down the red blood cells and the white blood cells and the platelets and then bile, and those were the four different axioms of how you would read your purpose or place within society. There are two things there which are interesting. One, it's obviously a pretty, you know, conservative and like feudal way to look at what fulfillment means for an individual, and there being some predetermined way to understand what that is, which is difficult to comprehend now when you think about meritocracy and democracy. But on the other side, it goes back into this idea of purpose and being, and essence seems to be connected to the idea of fulfillment and the idea of almost carrying out the will that one was predetermined to do so. And that relationship to ritual, being able to affirm essence, there's a real interesting dynamic there. And I tried to bring that out through the way in which materials, specifically organic, what we deem to be called organic materials or organic composites, how they are convened and proposed, whether it be like a alabaster or sandstone, or whether it be plaster, or whether it be like a Nuro marble or a Carrara marble, treating them with a, you know, softer hand, a more humanistic take on, you know, blown out edges and exposed material surfaces, contrasting against quite a clean and precise language, seems to be a way to pair, you know, modernity with these eternal truths of how we've always related to material and ritual and essence.
Alchemy.
Alchemy is interesting, isn't it? The relationship between alchemy and innovation. I kind of think about historic British scientists who had like private alchemaic practices, but they couldn't publish their papers because they didn't want to be refuted. But there's always this interest between innovation and moving how we, you know, deal with material forward. And alchemy, I believe, is kind of part of that process. You know, there's a little bit more of like a relationship to ritual there historically, but it's just as innovative. And practically, alchemy, it's always been in my practice. You know, it's always been a talking point of how do you, you know, produce or bring forward a energy from a material. And this goes into another, you know, concept linked to essence, which is also linked to like Shintoism of, you know, each surface or material already has like a reverb or a living spirit of sorts, right?
Animism too.
Animism coming into play, right? And it's this idea of, well, actually it's kind of logical because at like, you know, cellular or composition level, everything is just kind of like, you know, atoms and core materials and different, you know, elements arranged and reproposed in a different order. And with that in mind, it gives you a little bit more autonomy over how you're actually bringing alchemic process practically, whether it be through fire, whether it be through erosion, And not just, you know, physical erosion, but by integrating materials to work with one another. And that might be through milk and honey. That might be through soaking wenge or oak in turmeric to soften the actual tissue of the material, to then allow for like a recontortion of how the material may respond to casting or to embalming or to waxing.
Yeah, just so the listeners know, you're actually using these materials in some of these works. Like, you know,
this is not theoretical.
Yeah, this is real. Like the turmeric and milk and honey become, as you put it, embalmed in these works.
Absolutely. This relationship to take two materials and cleave the materials to produce fundamentally a new material story or engagement feels like a practical way to contribute to the field of design. You know, so you have these philosophical interests that I just tend to have. It's kind of the way I was raised and what I just enjoy reading. Those texts and those thoughts all start to filter into practical case studies and practical experiments. And the practicality there isn't just, hey, I wonder what happens if you, you know, pair A and Z together. It's more so looking for a way to contribute conducively and earnestly to the field of design.
Yeah, so let's take turmeric.
You say turmeric, I say turmeric.
Let's take turmeric. And what is it about that material? What do you think it lends to the work? Because it's not obvious necessarily to a viewer that, like, oh, this has been, you know, embedded with turmeric.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Because there is, and I guess I'm going to bring in like an architectural perspective here. There's an elevation view, there's an overhead view, and then there's an isometric view on how I kind of look at materials and objects. There's always like a triptych. There's always like quadrants or a triptych, or like, you know, great things come in threes, calamities come in threes. And I try to integrate that way of viewing a material. When I think about the first layer of viewing turmeric, I'm thinking quite practically about the properties it has in terms of the richness of the staining, the richness of the color which can be applied, and how difficult it is to remove that organic substance or imprint. The second octave, I'm thinking about turmeric in terms of its properties as a material or food material, and what that does to the body in terms of the anti-inflammatory properties, its relationship to healing the body. There are almost these like cathartic associations that we have to turmeric and to the idea of like the antidote, which are interesting when you start thinking about ritual and you start thinking about alchemy and proposing some closer, more intimate relationship between a material and between the body. And the third element that I really look at when I think about turmeric, and again, looking at all objects from three different perspectives or different angles, is the historical trade routes that turmeric, of course, took under, you know, the British Empire, and the idea of the spice route and the trade routes also being a talking point here. And it's taking those three matters and then, you know, applying them on different octaves to another organic material. And in this case, we're talking about Plyon OSB, which veer on the edge of being organic materials, which also makes them quite interesting because they also have their own material journey. You know, the idea of decimated and shredded wood being recomposed with a acetate or with like a PU or a TPU or with some type of adhesive represents our relationship to organic matter and synthetic and technology. So there's this real joy of taking something that we deem to be organic and maybe don't see as a material, like turmeric, which has this historical implication, has a cultural implication, and has a, you know, perceptible, tangible implication of staining, and pairing that with a material which is half alive and half dead, that being Plyon and the synthetic. And that's where the alchemy kind of occurs, right? Because you're reintroducing a organic material with a half alive or half dead material, and you're seeing how the two engage.
When it comes to alchemy, there's also this visual language going on in your work, whether that's a reference to West African furniture or British brutalist architecture. Could you speak to that, the alchemy of the visual too, not just the material?
Yeah, completely. I think there are a few words that I kind of think about when I'm like writing some of these ideas down as well. And like, there's the existential view and then there's the absurdist view, right? Of like, how does, you know, what is the relationship between brutalist architecture, you know, in like the 11th or 12th arrondissement, or, you know, even any type of like council estate in Handsworth in Birmingham, or, you know, or in like Brixton in London, or just Middle England? How does that have a relationship to Benin bronze sculptures or, you know, Edo period birthing chairs? And I think that absurdity or that connection, one is absurd, what is absurd, and it's a connection, which is the interesting paradox to play with of where you pool information from, is by way of empire, you know, and the existence of the voice that is speaking now is by way of empire. So to kind of pool from these different influences and realities, which again, live on their own time lapse, right? There is no linear view of time I'm looking for. I'm pretty much pooling these experiences and pulling them together. And I'd say with this body of work, it's gone beyond the politeness of feeling a need to gently reference. And it's more of a, you know, a view of, no, I am both. I am, like, from my bloodline, I am African. I am West African. Though by way of, you know, a British Caribbean identity, that's what the genome says. But I am also, you know, the product of brutalist architecture. All of my core memories and formative memories and childhood memories are within these facades. Thus, I know it. Thus, I will the two together. And that's how these worlds start to come together. And it's also like, you know, almost, you know, finding such comfort in being able to will what you know and experience. And that's almost the beauty of being like a relatively young contributor to the arts and to design, is the confidence to simply do that.
Relatively young at 32.
31 still. hanging on for dear life.
Oh yeah, you'll be 32 when this episode comes out, probably, I guess.
Likely, yeah.
This week, coincidentally, I started reading this book, Lapidarium, The Secret Lives of Stones, by the British art critic Hedy Judah. Mm-hmm. And there's some interesting crossover in it with your work. In the introduction, she writes, "We humans find it easier to think of abstract notions such as eternity than to enter the geological imagination and follow clues in stone that lead back over 4.5 billion years to the fiery origins of our planet." And she kind of gets to this technological aspect of stone too, that I think your work is exploring. She writes, "As well as evidence of a long and mysterious past, stone has provided the tools of human progress. From the earliest projectiles through cutting and grinding implements to rare minerals that power the present day information age." To me, I was just like kind of struck by these two quotes, but also this idea that your work is experimenting with some of this idea around the primordial and the root material, where these materials come from, how they become sort of mini memorials of where they came from.
Yes. Well, there's also this notion of what is material at like a composite level, right? And I think you think of mineral, you think of grain, you think of all of the axioms. And there's always this mythology provided with the material base. And I guess part of what I'm trying to do is embrace the reverence of mythology, but also start to really pick at the attributes at like a composite level to kind of open up newness in how we interpret those without supplementing or removing the core material. And I think that there's something there again, which goes back to this lapse in time and this buoyancy of these are fundamentally kinetic materials. If you think about the placement of alabaster and neuro and marble and slate, and to a degree now, you know, concrete and its tenure and its contribution across the last, maybe not so much of concrete because it's relatively new, material, but with the others across millennia. You know, these are materials that move fundamentally with us, or that we move through constantly and will continue to do so. And then it's about kind of contrasting the impermanence of the idea of synthetic against the idea of primordial, the idea of ritual, the idea of what's fundamentally what we believe to be there for eternity, which is what this literature also proposes. I'm quite keen to re-engage with that channel of thought on that proposition.
I have to mention the theme of memory here too.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like you can't talk about your work without talking about memory. How do you see memory embedded in your work, whether it's sculpture, a piece of furniture, a painting?
I think that, you know, memory is linked to, specifically in the furniture artworks, it's linked to the idea of purpose and essence in particular. And it's this idea of, again, like sentience and material. And practically, it's looking at the nature of how materials can continuously be re-engaged and re-proposed. People might hear that and they might think, oh, recycling. It's like, no, it's not really about recycling, because it's not about the placement or the form of how an object or material is used. It's more about changing the physical composition of how the material presents itself. And that proposition of almost awakening the materiality of a new composite, which is half synthetic and half organic, is such a good way to look at the majority of the materials that we engage with now. You know, even if we look at the CNC steel aluminum units in front of me, I start thinking about, you know, how does this idea of like at this point, a lead-free powder-coated sheet work with the oxidized proportion which could be brought forward from the aluminum. You know, it's always about awakening materials and trying to a degree humanize materials. There's a pliability with material that I'm quite keen to continue to explore and try to pair back to the essence of, in reality, all materials and surfaces are organic, though we treat them as though they're not. And I want to pull us closer to the idea of organic materials living.
For the listeners who can't see, it's a it's a Vitsu bookshelf that Indeed. Samuel's referring to. I wanted to also ask about your approach to just six objects in this exhibition, because, you know, there's a certain refinement and alignment happening, a real care in making and deciding what's included, what's excluded. Even though there's also a particular kind of roughness to the body of work in a way. These works have something to them that says they're of, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, of no place, or of, there's this tension between the specificity of them and yet the decentralization of them.
Yes. To give reference to maybe why there's such a focused body of work, I think it's probably underpinned by just like a life principle. I tend to just enjoy, you know, aesthetic spaces, which are really brought down to the crux of what they are trying to communicate, you know, whether that be through the form of like painting, or through the form of like CNC sculpture, or through the form of, you know, furniture, which almost veers on the edge of sculpture. The idea of focusing the experience gives enough space for the artworks or the furniture to speak. And by that, I mean giving the work space to breathe and to domineer an atmosphere that I want the viewer, really in this instance, it's the user. It's a huge difference, huge, huge, huge difference. The user to be able to see correctly, to be able to also feel the reverence of the artworks, to feel the familiarity of the artworks, to physically have all distractions removed from when they begin to touch and engage with the materials there. People have very different opinions. There isn't one view isn't better than the other. There is no hierarchy. But from my perspective, I've always wanted to focus the experience for the user. And so six pieces felt correct. There are, of course, you know, many more that were in the works. Even some of the drawings that were shown, only four drawings were shown out of 1,600 drawings for this collection, which isn't an exaggeration. It is a very well-rounded number, but it is around that amount which was produced. But even focusing, you know, the artworks down to six pieces being shown and only four drawings being shown, it really is about making sure that the experience remains distilled and emotional.
There's also these numbers and codes like embedded in some of these objects. And, you know, this is something your mentor and friend, the late Virgil Abloh, also played with in his work. And I was wondering, you know, let's just take Fire Open Stone, which is one of the works in the show, this bench-shaped granite and concrete work. Mm-hmm. I guess you could call it a bench.
Yes, yes.
What is it with those numbers in particular, how you treated that, and what are you thinking here in terms of these numbers or codes?
You know, I'm going to go back to the idea of the triptych and having, you know, like a multiple inputs justify or validate the decisions to have either a material or like a use of like typography be included within the bench or within the artwork. And this is a really good reference to that system and way of thinking to how some of these decisions are made. You know, the first notion immediately was the tension between the reverence of the material itself and that storied history that one thinks of when considering mineral stone, particularly Nero marble sourced in like the Dolomites. It has such a storied history. The other was, of course, the implication of commodifying what we would all deem, I would assume, to be like a sacred material with postmodern culture and the idea of the serial code. The third element there is the idea of the inscription and insignia historically, and the notion of the modern hieroglyph being the serial code to a degree. You know, there's like a sorting system there which is underpinned. There's a way of thinking there. It's indicative of other practicalities of what it means to live in modernity. You think supply chain, you think geography, you think distribution, you think margin, you think technology and process. So to have that counterbalance directly with material from millennia felt appropriate as an inscription of our era and our time. The second point there is the notion of mark making and the hieroglyph and the modern hieroglyph and what our contribution is to vernacular and literacy in the 21st century. Again, it's a 20th century matter, but it is still the barcode. We have emoji, we have meme, we have barcode. You know, we didn't come up with any new form of haiku or prose yet. Yeah, so it's also being quite practical in like operating as an artist and a designer of the time. How do I kind of document our contribution to literacy? And I guess that interest there, and as Virgil's was, we were both graphic designers, both trained in graphic design. So there's like a want to communicate through that graphic medium. And the third element to why the serial code or barcode was included was the implication of, I mean, it's kind of connected to the second, but it's a little bit more specific. The tension point between the hand engraved versus the CNC and automated relationships there is really interesting, you know, because that was partly CNC'd and partly hand engraved. And I love this tension point between organic and synthetic, humane and inhumane, humane and automated. And that, you know, teetering edge that our generation sits on, that we live in, is indicative of how the font and serial code is applied.
I love how you think in threes. This is fascinating. Is that like a sort of rigor that you bring to your thinking, that like as you're processing certain decision-making, you're thinking in threes?
Typically, yeah. I think that it's one of the additives of my working, you know, product primarily. And, you know, thinking about volume and scale, of course, we all need to think about ROI, KPI, marginality, raw material, sourcing patterns, all of these elements. It's applying like practical thinking to like philosophical thinking or free thinking, maybe. That's a lazy term, but you know what I mean. You know, thinking which has no type of boundary. But there's also the critique, as you were saying, where like I am obsessed with the lack of rigorous critique amongst the artistic and design community and its lack of formality. If we're to kind of add to the books of human history, which we all are, surrounding design and the arts, we just need to make sure that we are all comfortable with what's being quantified and why it's being quantified. And I feel like the idea of, hey, I felt this, so I made it, it's just not really that appropriate at all times. We've really got to start to push one another a little bit more. And that's where this triptych system of almost like bulletproofing a concept and making sure that it makes sense from like a historical or philosophical standpoint, and then from like a material or technology standpoint, has some type of rooting or grounding, then it feels like a contribution to the arts. And I guess this is where like maybe there's like a sliver of maturity coming into my practice where, I mean, to be honest, none of my work has ever really been about, hey, this is how I feel, so this is what I want to say. It's always been a commentary, whether it's in, you know, democratizing fashion between luxury and streetwear and talking about the relationship of like public housing and it's in sociology and anthropology, or whether it's been about some of these themes within course, which really look at the human experience. Yes, through like a tilted diasporic British Caribbean lens, but fundamentally it's about the human experience. And by taking a step back and putting myself in like, you know, the passenger seat, you get just like the view of like the rear view mirror. You get the blind spots that you might not see if you're constantly driving in front, not considering others in the room in your practice.
You also currently have this exhibition on view at White Cube in London. By the time this episode comes out, it won't be up still, but I did want to bring it up because it's your first solo exhibition as an artist and an important milestone in your practice. Two of the paintings, 9 hours and 7 hours. Maybe this is really on the nose given this is time sensitive, but I was like, oh, they're named about time. And I thought it would be interesting to hear you speak about those two works in particular from that temporal point of view.
Completely. And again, this notion of like the triptych returns. You have 9 hours, you have 7 hours, and then the third piece, which sits in that remit in terms of tonality and color, is called Candles Burn. And it's this idea of, to a certain degree, within like the medium of abstract painting, where there can be a little bit more of like an internal conversation happening, because I'm not necessarily considering service through the medium of like design or through furniture. I can be a little bit more quiet about the conversations that I may be alluding to. And 7 to 9 hours really talk about the travel time between core memories I have, which have now kind of shaped my use of color, my perception of what it is to be of a place, but not from a place. 7 to 9 hours, to be right on the nose, it's the travel time from Heathrow to St. Vincent, which is 9 hours, and the travel time from Heathrow to Barbados, which is 7 hours. And it's this interesting lapse between leaving one place that you supposedly are not of and going to another place which you are also not of but are of. And it's this interim, you know, almost like hyperbole between the two. And some of the placements of color elicit joy, but they also elicit the idea of the body and belonging. They also elicit possibly the idea of memory and trauma and genealogy, which is passed down by like the richness and the coarseness of some of the red hues that are presented, which are closer to like amber or burgundy and quite bodily in their way of presenting. But then you also have these really lucid geographical references to minimalist use of shape and asymmetry, which almost overlays with how the placement of like aerial photography and surveillance comes into play. So all of these cadences and elements of like a lived experience and different ways of seeing and reading systems come into play in those two paintings, but also in Candles Burn. And to talk about another triptych within the series, you have Closer to Dissonance, which sits in the middle of a series of three different paintings, which are quite gestural. But there's this idea that I can't produce any type of confirmation or affirmation or absolute piece of work as like a one and done process. There needs to be a returning. It's quite cyclical. This idea of repetition across the practice.
There's also this sensory element to the exhibition, including smell, the burning of incense, a scent that was, from what I understand, inspired by your grandmother's home in Brixton, and a soundscape. What was the thinking in terms of this sort of full body experience?
You know, the thinking with the senses being met also allude to time and place. I'm kind of challenging myself to ensure that my engagements within the arts and within design aren't too on the nose at times, but they also offer a window into like a human experience and into a living artist and their references and their influences. And there's a little bit of a breakdown of a facade of the expectation of what an artist can share whilst they're living. You know, you often hear about, you know, oh, this was the kind of setup, or this was the childhood home of X, and this is where they frequented 70 years ago, 90 years ago, and this was part of the formation of their identity. As my, you know, my first solo in fine art at White Cube, it felt like an opportune shift for a living artist in their first solo to start to directly share some of these immediate influences to not explain, but shape some of the thinking behind the works being proposed. Similar to, you know, a good friend of mine, I've known this individual for years. She's brilliant, Rhea Dillon. She is a conceptual artist and a fine artist, also British Caribbean, who veers between, you know, object and abstraction and minimalism. And, you know, her use of, you know, dyed mahogany, you know, her use of cut glass and Rabica cement. And these are immediate influences of the British Caribbean experience and that pendulum swing between the islands and between what our grandparents would have called the mother state, you know, which is a difficult term, but one I'm engaging with because it is part of the vernacular of the house, right? And part of the influence. We are starting to really add, like Rhea does this really well also, we're humanizing the influences, and it feels like we're being quite honest in terms of what we have to offer to the arts by doing that. To answer your question about scent and memory, you know, I feel like the statement you made was almost the answer, which is also quite beautiful in its simplicity of it's a process and ritual that is so linked to how I kind of almost like soften my aperture. I have to engage with ritual before entering any type of like seance with material practice and, you know, burning incense and using scent to fill space and using scent as a tool that can affect environment is really quite key to that. And I wanted to bring an element of that studio process into the gallery. You know, even the actual proportion of the doorway at White Cube, I changed only for our room. So, you know, typically they have a doorway opening of around, you know, 300 centimeters, 3 meters. I forced the door down, the doorway down to around 120 centimeters, you know, and I also increased the total height of the door opening. So it's the idea of even entering a vessel, entering a new facade practically through architecture, through space, through scent, which will go into the idea of ritual and seance and essence again.
It almost sounds to me like this notion of sacred space in a way too, like you're intentionally entering something sacred.
Absolutely. And there's a void which again keeps presenting itself, which is obviously linked to the idea of self and the gray area between modern spirituality and religion and essence and being, and like the ghost in the shell prospect, which is really interesting, which I'm absolutely for. But there also seems to be this unhinged relationship we all have to the idea of the sacred and the idea of reverence through material that we cannot escape. And I'm keen to simply explore that channel of thought and repropose it.
Hey everyone, taking a quick break here to tell you a little bit about our Season 7 presenting sponsor, the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels, which this year is working with the American Museum of Natural History in New York to present the exhibition Garden of Green, Exquisite Jewelry by Van Cleef & Arpels at the museum's Mignone Hall of Gems and Minerals. On view from June 10th, 2023 through January 2024, Garden of Green will showcase 44 creations from the French High Jewelry House, 32 of which will be on view in the U.S. for the first time. Creating a lush garden of jewelry, this impressive array of precious and ornamental stones will form a dazzling journey that celebrates the beauty of gardens and nature. To learn more, visit www.amnh.org/exhibitions. That's www.amnh.org/exhibitions. And now, back to the episode. Researching for this interview, I came across a couple conversations in which you mentioned Sandra Perry's book, Typhoon Coming On,
yeah,
about the Black diaspora as this decentralized monolith. And I wasn't familiar with it, so I wanted to bring it up here. Learning about it made me think of some other really essential work that connects to it, including Christina Sharp's In the Wake and Sadia Hartman's Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments. Both of those books are also kind of exploring that notion and the sort of afterlife of slavery and what happens in that time, the after, the wake.
And it's so interesting, isn't it? You know, there's such a good piece of literature that Sandra put together and one that I continue to read and refer to, and it's just etched in my memory as like a good talking point and a good influence. The notion that Sandra proposes is that the displacement of the African diaspora by way of colonial trade operates with the same asymmetry that digital space does. And the ability to reconvene and communicate asymmetrically, you know, almost from like a scattergram approach versus a linear approach, is almost embedded into the Black experience. And I think this is absolutely true. There are stats that she put forward. I mean, the book came out maybe 6 years ago now, around 2017, around 2018, I think. And at that point, one of the stats put forward was that roughly 65 to 75% of all Instagram users were actually African American across the board. And there's this interest and almost influx of communication, which is decentralized across a network, which is almost, I don't know, for some reason, it feels like it's just like a very much organic or known behavior. You know, I think about the decentralized tactics of any civil rights movement and how that's embraced and engaged. And we're fundamentally talking about the children of, or, you know, the grandchildren of that movement participating in commune. And also the want and yearning that I feel as part of the diaspora to want to engage with others cross-continent, specifically surrounding shared experience. Although everyone has a particularly different difficulty, whether it be economic or class-based, there's still a open fissure or an open wound or limb that we are all trying to repair. And I think part of the absurdist and maybe existential view I have on time is linked to taking notions of what we deem to be the past and pairing them with matters of the now to almost unpick and replace, you know, like tissue and lining to kind of congeal maybe what was left open or bruised or wounded or infected and repropose what should have sat in place. And that's almost my job as like a British Caribbean artist who's part of the Black diaspora, is to contribute what is missing or what's been misconstrued or what doesn't yet exist. I know I went a bit on a bit very lucid there, but that's some of the thinking.
Well, yeah, you're filling certain voids. And, you know, I think Steve McQueen did that so beautifully with Small Axe.
Absolutely.
That series. I mean, I think for any outsider getting a view into that culture, it was just this like magical, alchemical experience
and,
watch that.
There's such a beauty with Small Axe. And I can really, and this is why I kind of brought up Rhea Dillon as well. And, you know, Steve, because we're all British Caribbean. So there's a specific relationship, you know, that Steve has to the West London Caribbean community, and that like I have to Southwest London, to Brixton Market, you know, which are, you know, focal points of that era and of that time. You know, like just for reference, it isn't like a voyeur on the area. I was born in Brixton. You know, my parents were married on top of Brixton Market. You know, you think about the riots and the civil rights movement. Like my mum grew up around that. My father was based there for such a long time. That is fundamentally etched into the history of Black Britain. And the responsibility to make sure these, it's not really messages, it's more like perspectives are earnestly told. That feels as important as to talking to, you know, the canon of what it truly was like to engage with brutalism or postmodern architecture on an intimate level, and what it is to live through those material experiences, and how that then shaped the psyche of how, you know, the work comes about now that I'm producing. It's always this wonderful pendulum swing of British Caribbean diasporic experience, meeting brutalism, meeting postmodernism, meeting the need for a closeness and reverence to organic matter and material, which is a human need. Again, it's a triptych. It's always an octave. It's not one viewpoint, you know, or one vanishing point that I'm looking at. You know, I mean, there's the John Berger piece when he talks about the vanishing point, which reoccurs in like imperialist painting across like the 17th and 18th century on the shoreline, of the idea of the protagonist going out into the unknown world. I could easily have a similar vanishing point with like the, you know, the idea of like diasporic art, you know, this is what I want to talk about, but I want to talk about octaves of the human experience. And that's one octave I know intimately. The other is architecture and materiality. And then the other is simply what it is to be human starts to come into place, which is truly just grappling with the humanity that we all know. And those intimacies that we often don't speak, but we know to be truths or thoughts. I'm trying to propose that as like revelation in some of the work as well.
Yeah. Too often the nuance just gets paved over. And then
it does.
Let's go back to your upbringing in Northamptonshire. You began sculpting at a young age. I learned at age 3 in a nursery. You were raised by your second generation Windrush parents, who you mentioned earlier. Your father had formerly run this anarchist church.
Indeed.
In Brixton, and your mother homeschooled you.
Yes.
Growing up, you spent a lot of time alone as a child.
Indeed.
Drawing, painting, crafting things. It seems like, from what I learned anyway, your parents practically shaped you into being an artist. And I was hoping you might speak to that time a little bit. And connected to that, you also grew up in the church. You even pursued theology before studying art and design. Is that where ritual came in?
I think, yeah, I think there, firstly, it was a wonderful upbringing. And I'm so you know, I'm enamored by the desire they had to kind of input so much information so early on continuously. And that's the gift of being raised by academics, I guess. You know, like, yeah. I'm so fortunate that I was like the homeschooled test tube kid for like 4 to 5 years. It was like, oh, hey, we're pulling you out of school, and yes, you're going to do, and you know, follow like the expected academic, you know, route, but we're also going to spend time building computers with you. You know, we're going to spend time building pinhole cameras. You know, you're coming with me to my glass technology MA course. You know, hey, I'm restoring this 16th century glass for like a church in Oxford. You need to know about this. You know, and on my mother's side, there is just this love of education that channeled through her, because her upbringing didn't really afford it. She left Brixton at the age of 9 or 10 due to like extreme trauma, and was raised in Barbados for around 8 to 9 years. And she had to return to the UK because we couldn't afford, at that point, our family just couldn't afford any form of education. And she returned to the UK, met my father through the church, and she, you know, started in like community colleges all the way up to getting like a, you know, MA, and now she's writing her PhD in sociology. And, you know, she kind of lectures and teaches full time as like an academic. So because she had me at the age of like 22, I believe, around that point, I was almost part of her academic journey. So like, you know, I remember her being in like, you know, the helper, and then getting employed by the school when I was at the school. She was always kind of there for that journey. And I guess that kind of goes back to the point of the household, and the way in which we engaged with one another was through debate. It was through the exchange of ideas. There wasn't a topic that was kind of off the table. Like, your contribution in the home was expected to be a creative one and an expressive one, but also like an intellectual one to a degree. It's just what brought us closer. And even the idea of, you know, when did the artistic process begin for me? Because as artists recently, right on the nose, it's a great question. It's like, it's in my essence. This is my genealogy. There wasn't really, as you said, I was kind of shaped into this. It wasn't really a start point. It was just a way of being, and it's simply continued to be so. So when the question comes about of, how come you're in so many disciplines and fields, right? It's kind of like, well, you know, there's always an engagement with every sensory experience, and, you know, there's like a perspective and an opinion to kind of explore there. And it also simply comes from wanting to learn more about the field. It's just an inquiry, and the inquiry ends up shaping as an idea or a perspective or as a conversation, which then takes on like a physical form typically. And that way of, that way of being has just continued.
So we haven't talked about fashion yet.
No, we haven't.
You began your fashion journey with the streetwear brand To Want For. Is that pronounced correctly?
Yeah, it's an abbreviation of 24, but not the tightest abbreviation. Yeah. It's TWNT4, but I've heard everything from Twanta.
I was like, To Want For?
Yeah, I was you could tell I was still in design school at this point, figuring it out.
But this led to your discovery by Virgil Abloh, mm-hmm. In 2013. You've spoken so beautifully about your time with Virgil and about how he appointed you as his design assistant, the work you guys did with Pyrex Vision, Kanye West Donda, etc. I don't feel the need to like go deep into that. Listeners can definitely find you speaking about that elsewhere. But I did want to ask about your process with Virgil, which I think is fascinating from a time perspective, how you guys created this constant iteration and flow. Mm-hmm. You once said of your work with him that projects were complete only when time had stopped.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, you know, with Virgil, it's so rare to to fundamentally find a living practitioner who had the vigor of the masters and acolytes that we read about, you know, across like 19th and 20th century, to actually see someone practicing publicly without fear of failure, knowing that the process was a constant iteration, and with that level of, to be honest, like rigor and dedication to almost sacrifice any type of normalcy to contribute to the arts as a whole. I felt very early on in our time working together that this was a, you know, this is a historic inquiry, and you could feel that, you know, you've got this generation of people who have the hard skills and then like the soft cultural skills for the first time, being able to communicate freely to a degree as outsiders. And that gave autonomy, that gave mobility, it gave speed, it gave space for open thought, because there wasn't at this point, you know, firstly, we all wanted to work for like the pentagrams and the Sagmeister and Walsh. Like these are like, you know, this is the highest form of like visual communication, still is. And we wanted to work with these partners, but we also wanted to find a way to contribute like a new perspective, you know, and these new different cadences and nuances. There was this spirit that the work should embody optimism that felt truly like a contribution to the design sector and industry. Because of course, before working with V, I was at like product design agencies and advertising agencies, and it was like a pretty standardized track. And we all know how it can be. You know, it's, of course, it's rigor and critique. And sometimes that can actually hamper the newness that practitioners are so capable of. And that can sometimes slow down the path to expression or innovation and like a generation's contributions historically, right? Like we've been stuck in like the 1960s version of like minimalism for ages now. And with V, there was this desire to, specifically in his case, he wanted to widen the perspective, bring new perspectives in, and also break some of the old thinking, you know, and break down old channels of thought, or break down the old no and change it into a yes. And that's where the volume came about, you know, and that's where the idea of touching every surface and every discipline came about. Because when you're an outlier, and this at this point, he still was an outlier, right? He was Virgil, still known as Virgil, but he wasn't Virgil Abloh. Time 100, Virgil Abloh, still building in real time. And it was such a special time. I was completely dedicated to his practice and to what he needed to communicate at that point. And he was able to also invite other practitioners into dialogue. The idea of community and culture and design had felt like it had returned. You know, of course, we all kind of read about Lower East Side and like downtown in particular eras of like the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, in the UK, of course, we talk about, even though it's an art movement, still cultural impact of like, you know, the YBAs and the impact that had on like the artistic period there, in like the mid 90s and early 90s. This felt like it was a chapter of design culture and like design history opening up. I'm sure you probably felt some of that too, right? We could all kind of see this happening, flowering. And it was Virgil, but it was also Virgil as a catalyst to open this new chapter of like the, I guess, the creativity of the times.
At the age of 24, you launched a cold wall in 2015. And in many ways, this was more of an art project, at least at its impetus, than a fashion label. And I was hoping you might speak a little bit to the thesis behind it, because similar to what you were just saying about Virgil, this project really flowered too. I mean, it took off in a total, probably an unexpected way, but it was really rooted in this thesis.
Absolutely. You know, my my university thesis for my undergrad was rooted in the semantics and the semiotics of what the suit, the history of the suit across, you know, the 20th century enabled in terms of like social mobility and the idea of being able to kind of move across different echelons of society, and how fashion can be like a interesting forum for social change in that regard, right? And, you know, when it came to founding a Cold War and that thesis and that dissertation it was rooted in, it was literally like a 2,000-word think piece. This is after, you know, I'm 2 years in working with you know, Virgil at this point and working on Donda-related projects at this point. And I'm kind of seeing this canon of thought, which is purely African-American, right? And it's really strong and it's pronounced. And like, this is the ideology, this is the expectation, and this is the experience which is now being channeled through the medium of fashion at that time, through those practitioners, through Jerry, through V, through Ye. And I would, of course, be the satellite in Europe for V, or in Europe for whatever V needed done on behalf of Donda. And I realized it was wonderful to contribute and aid that experience, but I also need to consider what I have to contribute to the field as a British Caribbean individual. You know, after one fashion week, it was after the Kanye APC second season, I kind of went back home and started to just write. I reached for the old dissertation I wrote on menswear, and I started to think about to a degree, the lack of alignment with my personal experience in terms of where I was raised, what I knew to be true, the Black British experience, and the working class experience with architecture and with space as immediate influences to form this paper, to really start writing about what is the British working class experience with engineering and material and color profiles and texture. And really, it's kind of like an early anthropology paper. And all of those inputs and thoughts and experiences, which were written within Northamptonshire, formulated the blueprint for a Cold War. It was always this abstraction, because the paper itself was very informal, very abstract. And of course, there was an impetus to have ready-to-wear basics in there. But I was far more concerned with the materiality of the clothes and how the clothes could tell some of these particular stories and influences.
And you build this incredible business out of it.
Yeah, which have like, you know, we have like five, you know, global mono stores now, from like Selfridges to Harrods to, you know, Shanghai to Beijing. It's now 8.5 years old, and it's really blossomed and bloomed. And we have these legacy partnerships with like Nike and Converse and Timberland. And we have shown runways in London to Milan. And there's this real culture within a Cold War, which was birthed from the unseen and the unheard. But I believe that story and pathway of unseen and unheard has worked out. And the company has bloomed and flourished because it wasn't specific to myself. It was a read of maybe what was being internalized across society and wasn't really being spoken about. You know, like the 0.01%, you know, the 0.01%. And there's the other 99% who have a different experience. And it just really wasn't being captured through the medium of fashion. And there was something to contribute there, which is why it kind of stands as a pillar now, almost a decade onwards.
And it's interesting, it afforded you personally the opportunity to break out of fashion and get into what we talked about for the first
Spencer can see
90% of this interview.
Absolutely.
And in addition to that, it also afforded you the opportunity to create the Black British Artist Grants.
Yes.
Which you created in 2020.
Yep.
As this effort to, you know, mean, what are your hopes with it? Because is it your own small way of lifting others up just as Virgil once did with you?
There's two really good points there. You know, Coldwell did afford the mobility and the means to contribute and build like a much more critical and rigorous practice in the arts. There was also this returning to the arts and to design almost, because, you know, I studied graphic design and illustration and then went into like product design. That was my first like formal juncture in as a practitioner. And I then moved over into fashion because I felt like at that point there's something to really communicate and contribute in that medium. But I almost feel as though I've kind of like returned. I've almost returned back to like the core interests. And I feel like in this particular chapter of, you know, the history of design and art, I have something to contribute to the arts and to design. And I guess this is where there are quite methodical decisions that are made on my behalf. It's less, this is what I feel, so I should do it. It's like, no, where is there a piece of paper to add? Where is there a foreword or like a, you know, a thesis or a perspective which maybe should exist but doesn't exist? And it's always quite like a methodical process. And to the second point on the grant program established, you know, it's really easy to kind of have like coffee table conversations and like dinner conversations about what should change and what should happen. And I was kind of starting to slip into that rut where, you know, I'd go to dinner with peers and contemporaries and friends and say, hey, why isn't X in the room? Why isn't Y in the room? Why isn't there X program for Y? And I just kind of got a little bit tired of getting caught in that way of thinking. It felt a little bit like regressive and it didn't feel like it was who I am. So I decided to build a advisory board, which is part of the Black British Grant Program. And the advisory board was formed to make sure that exceptional talents and contributions to the arts and to design and engineering and architecture and fashion, of course, are acknowledged and supported. So the support part is, you know, we produce 10 to 12 grants annually for £2,500, which is all, for the most part, self-funded for the first 3 years. And even to now, 90% of that is self-funded from, you know, SRAR, Industrial Design Practice. And the whole prospect there is to identify the talent, but bring the talent to the forefront of historic institutions and corporations and academies to make sure that talent is well placed and can build a prolific career, hopefully. So the board is formed of the Royal College of Art, the British Fashion Council, the V&A Museum.
Where you had a show last year.
Where I had a show last year as well, which is wonderful. We have corporate partners who are involved, whether it be, you know, Nike or also Apple, on like a soft support front. The Design Museum, of course, are also involved and part of that board. We have the University of Westminster, who are part of that board. And the whole idea is to also have contributing guests on an annual basis. So our guest advisor for 2022 was Grace Walls Bonner, who's a dear, dear friend of mine. It's this idea of, it's not enough just to have talent. It's also the honesty and the earnesty to look at the placement of the talent and the, you know, the framing of how talent is seen. And through that program, these are already practitioners who are brilliant. And this is almost the point of the program. It's not to maybe break talent. It's to make sure talent that is exceptional is seen. So Mac Collins, who went on to win the Salzman Prize at the Design Museum, is a recipient. Nefemi Marcus Bello, who was awarded the grant in 2021, then went on to win the 2022 Hublot Design Prize at Serpentine, which I advise on the board for there to ensure there's a funnel and pipeline. Rhea Dillon, who of course now has the solo, she's had two solos at Soft Opening, and she has her show, of course, at Tate Britain as a permanent installation through till June 2024, I believe. Once it launches at the end of May 2023, also went through the program. It's really a case of just doing and like taking the resources that SRA and a Coldwell have afforded me and placing them into the public forum. And that feels just like what should be happening, you know. And as you were saying, a Cold War SRA have flowered and they're flowering. My view has never been to kind of sit in this tower of isolation, like an ivory tower, and just kind of like hedonistically pour copious amounts of time and expenditure into like what we maybe don't need. It's always been to like affirm that there is a generation of thinkers and designers, and to make sure that's documented historically.
Before we finish, I have to bring up your honorary doctorate. Pretty incredible that the University of Westminster gave you this honor in November 2021. What was it like for you to receive that? You weren't even 30 yet.
Yeah, I was 29. It's the youngest honorary doctorate PhD for the arts they've given historically since their inception. It is a feeling it's an expectation you just don't have, right? You know, you kind of practice and you contribute to field and you will and you do the work, and then you get this email. And then, you know, the email came almost 18 months after doing like a series of talks and lectures at Westminster University for the MA course. And to, you know, contribute to a field and feel as though maybe some of it's been seen or acknowledged. I'm still kind of speechless over that matter. It also maybe speaks to this like desire for like academia that I'm kind of obsessed with, whether it be like self-taught or, you know, even, you know, on academia, if we just talk about that for 2 seconds, you know, speaking to the RCA about potentially doing the MFA, and they were like, no, you don't need to. And I'm like, no, I want to though. I want to have critique. I want to be in discourse with peers. And the relationship I have with academia has always been this hybrid of like, I guess, kind of being young, but also like lecturing and like teaching on like an ad hoc basis through programs or through building these programs. And I want to keep building on that. You know, I think any type of artist I kind of look up to or think makes critical work has this constant report with education, you know, for a cycle of a career. So when the honorary PhD came about, it felt great, but I also intend to, you know, continue studying formally and teaching and contributing to, you know, chairs and different circles academically as much as just producing my own works, because it's really about sharpening a perspective and a contribution.
So how are you thinking about this present moment, the right now? And I ask because you've mentioned this particular moment of time we're in, broadly speaking, is really a remarkable pocket of time for people of color.
Yes.
And I was hoping you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, I think my view is always like a historical standpoint. I try to see and sometimes not feel the implications and the harshness of what it is to exist as a human cross society. You know, I always try to have this step back and have like an anamorphic or like a wide lens view. And that means operating with some parity too, which sometimes can be difficult because, you know, I kind of believe in humanity before having like a political view. So I'm not totally apolitical, but I believe in like, you know, humanity first. And with that in mind, I kind of look at the last throw of, hey, let's be to the point, 400 or 500 years. I look at that on both sides of the equator, right? I look at like traditional feudal systems where if you owned a horse in Edo, Japan, you'll get indexed 95% on any profits that horse drives, you know? You know, which completely wipes out the idea of the merchant intentionally and the idea of the entrepreneur. I kind of look at bans and ledgers that were placed to rebuke the manufacturing of papyrus leaves across the European empires of the 12th and 11th century to stop people having access to literature and why parchment was chosen instead of papyrus. Because it's very hard to skin down an animal and to sit there and work into leather. You know, you can't use a press to do that, you know. And I guess where I'm going with this is access to resource and access to information has always been a difficult feat across millennia. And we are in a pocket of time where in, you know, an open democratic society and a free trade economy, where anyone can register an LLC or a limited company in 45 minutes from the tap of a few keys on a computer. Anyone can go into a library and pick up any type of information they wish to digest. And historically, that just hasn't been the case. If you think of like the struggle of potters such as Dave, who, you know, had to hide their poetry and inscribe it into pottery, even though it was illegal for them to be literate at that point. You know, and then you think about how easy information is accessible now. And I think about the strifes of like previous living generations I have within my bloodline. This is the Gilded Age. And, you know, it's not going to last forever. You know, I was speaking to a good friend and a good mentor of mine, Jerry Lorenzo, who runs Fear of God, who's done, you know, he's reached this exceptional feats. We were in LA last week and we were just kind of talking at his studio base. You know, he just kind of threw out the comment of, yeah, man, this age isn't going to be here forever. And I couldn't agree more. You know, so once we have this pocket of autonomy to be able to source materials, start LLCs, have incredibly niche perspectives documented and heard, we need to acknowledge that is a very much special time for, you know, the diaspora, but also just humanity. Taking a step back and having the wide lens view, let's not discredit that at all. There's, of course, work to be done. There's always work to be done. But this is an incredibly specific pocket of time one has to express themselves and to add creatively, philosophically, you know, in terms of, you know, building materials and support for others. Let's leverage that. It might sound very optimistic and altruistic, but that's just my stance, you know.
Final question. How are you thinking about the future? And I mean this in whatever sense you want to answer it, philosophically, literally.
I am still surprised our view of the future is the same view that we had in like the 60s and the 70s, almost like half a century on. I mean, you'll know this, there's been so much writing on like the death of the future and this kind of like time lapse we're in. And that's not that the future is to be harrowingly bad. It's more so like the philosophy of what a future means. And actually, it depends on what catchment of the future we talk about too. I guess I'm thinking more from like a social standpoint. Although we're in like a brilliant window, it maybe feels like there's a little bit of a regression in terms of how the left and the right engage and the perspectives of the left and the right building like a well-balanced equilibrium. That feels like it needs a little bit of work, maybe, because you need both to have a balanced and free society where people can feel that they can express their needs, their desires, and their concerns. It's super important that meritocracy stays in place. So I'd like to see much more of like a center point or a center axis return in the coming future a little bit. It's really important just in terms of ethics, right? I think about the past a lot when considering the future. I was with a friend at the Magna Carta site, which of course was placed after King John really had a bash with society and mashed it up to run around with language, you know, like, and I think about like what the Magna Carta represented and still represents as a ledger of autonomy. So I think maybe the near future is more about a reminder of what a modern society is supposed to inhibit and reaffirming that through like balanced perspectives being heard, super important. And when I think about technology and I think about the arts and design and I think about writing, there's a real interest there into the new advent of traditional artistic mediums producing new movements. You know, I think about the relationship between the advent of the camera at the top of the 19th century through to the 1930s and 20s when it entered public forum, and the elasticity that offered to the medium of traditional painting and what followed onwards of that. I also feel that will be the same for Western literature and our contributions to the medium. And I believe it will enter a far more abstract and like psychedelic phase of like forming poetry and forming sentence structure. Because once we can kind of automate off a sneaker drop post, which we don't need human spirits spending too much time on, it's a service, right? Once we can get that out of the way, the affirmation of what makes, you know, an individual a writer, or the individual a painter, or the individual specifically in architecture, an architect or an engineer, will be further defined to offset the banal tasks which need to happen at a service level, which we will then place into, you know, AI. And it's just really the next chapter of AI, you know, like a digital, like a film camera is a piece of AI, a CNC machine is a piece of AI. And I'm keen to see these new artistic movements and principles of how we engage with one another come about.
Samuel, thank you so much for coming today. This is really a treat to sit down with you.
A joy and an honor. Thank you so much.
Extra thanks to our Season 7 presenting sponsor, the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels. Van Cleef & Arpels' jewelry is characterized by a distinctive blend of poetry and refinement. With its iconic jewelry collections, it is an invitation to a timeless universe of beauty and harmony. You can discover more at VanCleefArpels.com. That's VanCleefArpels.com. And thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of Time Sensitive on our website, timesensitive.fm, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To join the Slowdown's new membership program, which provides access to subscriber-only newsletters, in-depth stories, immersive interviews, curated recommendations, and exclusive event invitations, go to slowdown.tv/subscribe. That's slowdown.tv/subscribe. Our theme music was composed by Billy Martin. This episode was produced by Ramon Broza, Emily Jang, and Johnny Simon.